Back in the early years of the Persian rise to greatness, while Cyrus was still in Lydia, he'd found himself unexpectedly visited by a delegation from across the Aegean Sea. The ambassadors were Greek, but quite different from the Greeks of Asia, whose cities, prosperous and tempting, Cyrus was plotting at that very moment to crush and make his own. The strangers wore their hair long. They sported distinctive red cloaks. They spoke not with the subtlety and sense of propriety that conventionally marked an ambassador's language, but bluntly, rudely. The message they gave the greatest king on earth was simple. Cyrus should leave the cities of the Ionians well alone. If he did not, then he would have to answer to those who had sent them, the Spartans. Cyrus, turning from them, was obliged to summon a nearby Ionian attendant. "Tell me," he demanded, all bemusement, "who are the Spartans?" A startling question for any Greek to have to answer. Nothing could better have illustrated the remote and alien quality of the Persians than the fact that they were ignorant of history's most notorious woman. Helen of Sparta, hundreds of years before, had brought ruin to Asia as well as Greece. Her abduction from the home of her husband, King Menelaus, to the fabled city of Troy had made all the world bleed. For 10 long years, the heroes of East and West had butchered each other in the dust of the Trojan plain. Only with the annihilation of what, in the opinion of the Greeks, had been Asia's greatest city, the slaughter of its men and the enslavement of its women, had the terrible war at last been brought to an end. Asia invaded and Trojan power wiped out merely for the sake of a single Spartan woman. Certainly the ambassadors, long-haired and scarlet-cloaked, would have appeared apt devotees of sensual and pleasure-loving Helen. For Cyrus would have had sufficient opportunity to learn that the wearing of long hair among the Greeks was generally regarded as evidence of effeminacy, and the use of expensive vermilion as a mark of wild extravagance. The Persians, unsurprisingly, chose to scorn the Spartans' ridiculous pretensions. Surely they could have little to fear from such a luxury-loving race. Appearances, of course, could be deceptive. But it was true that once, in the earliest years of their history, the Spartans had indeed been notorious for their materialism and greed. Sparta, in the 8th and 7th centuries BC, had served as a model of everything that other Greeks hoped to avoid. Her elite was brutal and rapacious. Its land hunger was obscene. The impoverishment of the average citizen, leached of his patrimony and often even of his freedom, was shocking. Among the Greeks, however, the yearning for eunomia, for good governance, had a particular urgency. With no ready models of bureaucracy or centralization to hand, the Greek world had early on fragmented into a multitude of competing city-states, each with its distinctive brand of constitutional crisis. The mountains, which hemmed in the lowlands, afforded many states autonomy as well as isolation. The Spartans, certainly, had profited from the location of their city. That they had been left free to indulge their taste for class warfare had owed almost everything to geography. Lacedaemon, the territory in the remote reaches of southern Greece which their city dominated, was framed all around by formidable natural bulwarks. To the east and south, the sea. To the north, grey, forbidding hills. To the west, savage and immense, the mountain of Taygetos, its five claw-like peaks streaked with snow even in the heat of summer.